This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 28 for Thursday, October 8th, 2009. Robinette, gentle Robinette. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Welcome to another episode. Welcome to Out of Line After Hours. As always, Thursday nights, joined by my favorite auto extremist of all time, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter, great having you here.
Great to be here, John, once again.
I know. And David Welch with Business Week. David, great having you here, too.
Thanks, John. Always a pleasure.
And we got a special guest joining us for this
evening. Special, wow.
Yeah. Michael Robinette from CSM Worldwide. Where you're the head of, like, it's industry forecasts or something like that.
I do, right? All the vehicle, I head the vehicle forecasting group.
Well, that's pretty close on my part. Close going by memory, that's pretty good. So a lot of news in this industry this week. First thing I think we got to talk about is what went on at GM with Mark LaNeve. And I got to pick that because Mark was very gracious to come and spend an evening here with us before, too. And Peter, I can't imagine it surprised you that he's leaving the company.
No, not at all. I think the moment that he was moved to sales, he was probably starting to look. I mean, Mark bleeds GM blue, so he didn't take it lightly, but I think he made the decision he had to do what was best for him. And I know where he's going.
So do I.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us, like, what direction he's heading in?
He's going west in the Midwest, and it's in the insurance industry.
Oh, wow. Big change then. Well, yeah, you must have been reporting on this week, Dave.
Yeah, I wrote a story on the web yesterday about it. Mark, I think, had to go. Once they took the marketing duties away and gave it to Lutz.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, let's look at the big picture here. Ed Whitaker is saying he wants to see market share results, at least some traction pretty soon, and he wants to see them get 20%. Or more next year.
It's not going to happen.com.
No, I don't think it is. And Bob Lutz is running marketing. Bob is very well liked by the automotive task force, and he's also sort of in many ways the heart and soul of the company in terms of its public image and you know, his persona. He's got a lot of job security. So what happens if they don't hit that 20? You know, who's the guy who's, you know, doubling his, you know, who's the king's body double? Who's going to take the bullet? You know, I think Mark was on the firing line and he knew it. And I think he probably saw it as a demotion when he lost the marketing stripes. But, I think he saw he was on the line and probably figured, I'm going to do what's best for my career and go somewhere else.
I think it's unfortunate. I think Mark, Mark was right in the lines. Then he had it was almost a no-win situation in some respects, because if you talk about 20% market share, that's going to be very, very difficult next year. And I think the other factor, once you lose Saturn and Hummer goes away and Saab, and I mean, you almost do the math and realize
it's a dream. How can you talk about 20% when you get rid of all those brands?
And 20%, that harkens back to the old days where Detroit was all about moving the metal. And if you look at some of the lessons we're seeing out of Dearborn, you know, they're not doing absolutely everything right, but they're standing back a little bit and they're saying to themselves, you know, maybe we should look at some better quality market share. And frankly, that's probably what GM really should be looking for in the future.
But BB, let's give Whitaker a little bit of credit here. When he first said that, and it was his first conference call with reporters after he was named chairman, he said he wanted to gain market share. The 20% actually came out in my story. They haven't said that publicly, but it's true. That's what he wants. But when he said, I want to gain share, he wasn't talking about the old days of buying it with fleet sales and incentives and that sort of thing. He wants profitable share, which actually makes it a lot tougher, because think about it. They're at 19.5 right now. The four brands they're getting rid of represent almost 3 points of share right now, year to date, as far down as those brands are, and some of them are down 60%, and that's still 3 points of share. Now, most of that is basically it's the Pontiac
and some of the fleet stuff.
Yeah. And Aura. And they can make up some of that with Chevy, but they're not going to keep all three points.
No, talk about the numbers. Look, even in its very weakened state, Saturn's did what last year? 180,000?
Yeah, and unfortunately
like
it was among three or four different vehicles, so it was all over the place.
Try to make up with any, even with the combination of GM's brands, just what Saturn represents in a bad year, 180,000 units. Where are you going to claw that out of?
Yeah, so I think Mark, I'm sure when they moved him, I'm sure in his mind he was probably talking to recruiters the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mark's sharp enough to...
To see the handwriting.
Well, it's a no-win situation. It really is. So
what do you make of Susan Dougherty taking the place?
I'm not really thrilled about that. You know, I don't think I've been more pessimistic about General Motors than I am right now.
Wow. Peter, well, that's quite a statement.
And I think they've got great design and engineering talent. They've got some great products going, but there is a disconnect going on down there, and I don't know what the problem is. But, you know, Susan is competent enough and everything, but, you know, it's almost like, well, you're next up on the firing line. You know, we're out of ideas. When Bob takes his leave, it's probably going to be Brent Dewar. And, you know, I'm just not optimistic right now about GM. I'm really not.
Wow.
Well, the appointments raised some eyebrows inside GM. I know that. I mean, look, most recently, she came up with a Buick marketing and advertising plan that...
Take a look at me now.
Yeah, that Bob basically deep-sixed.
Right.
So
well, that tells you something, though, that she's getting this job.
Well, someone said to me, you know, this is the old GM where they're rewarding bad performance. You know, I don't know that she was in Buick long enough to really, you know, market these new products and for her to, you know, to get a grade on this thing, but she's going to have, I mean, she's got a really, really tough job. Now, Susan Dougherty's very tough, and, you know, she's sharp, but it's, you know, who's going to do well in that job? It's really going to be difficult for them to gain market share.
Depends how you measure your performance. If you measure it in total market share and total sales, you may as well blow your brains out now. But if you say, no, my new measure of performance is, let's take the four brands we're keeping, and what do I do with them from here? And if that becomes your benchmark, then she could perform well. But this 20% market share, I just can't see that. And it's not like I don't believe they can't or don't have it. The numbers are impossible.
You know what's interesting is when they came out of bankruptcy, the most important thing was announced that day. It was not Bob coming back or some of the other restructurings in the executive committee. It was the fact that they put GM International focused was completely out of Shanghai. That should have told everybody that as soon as they get some semblance of stability here, they're going to focus a lot of their resources and capital and money on Asia. And in fact, they're taking over floors of the Jinmao Tower right now in Shanghai. They are rocking and rolling in China right now. It is absolutely unbelievable how well they're doing in China.
That's the only place they're profitable.
Yeah.
I think it also
are they making money in Brazil right now?
They actually did pretty well in Brazil. But if you think about it, GM International would be basically Korea, China, what they have in Australia. They've got a little bit in India. And then they've got South America, and then obviously Europe is more or less a minority position going forward. So it's really going to be fix North America, and let's focus a lot of resources on Asia.
Well, everybody's looking at Asia. I mean, that's where all the growth is going to be, just China alone. Then you throw India in, like you've been talking about. And it's not just GM, and it's not just automakers. Suppliers are doing the same thing. Everyone's going that way. But I will say this. I think there's going to be a lot of growth in North America, and the opportunity of making profit, I think, will even be greater here once the market comes back.
You know, the one thing about GM that, and I'm not as pessimistic as Peter, is simply because the new products coming out are really, really good. And they've taken care of a lot of the cost issues. I mean, they dropped that debt down big time. And the healthcare costs, when this whole VEBA thing gets sorted out, will be...
It'll be under control.
Yeah, it'll be under control, but, you know, dropping their debt down from, you know, well over $60 billion to, you know, under $17 billion, the interest payments on that were killing them, the interest alone, let alone the cash calls every time it came due. So there's going to be a lot of money freed up for product and for marketing. But, you know, the big thing here is, you know, you look at some of their vehicles that are really good, like Malibu. and the numbers just aren't there. The sales, it's a great car, but the sales, I mean, it gets outsold by the Fusion. You know what? The Fusion's a fine car. I'm not going to say it's a bad automobile. It's pretty good. I don't think it holds a candle to the Chevy Malibu. I mean, I really think that it's middle of the pack. It's slightly above middle of the pack. I mean, you basically have Malibu, yeah. Camry. I like the Mazda 6 quite a bit, the Accord, just because it's got some spoiled
tires. I think
the
09 Fusion checked a lot of boxes that were wrong with the old one. I mean, I really think the 09 Fusion, outfitted properly, is actually really...
That was a dramatic mid... It wasn't just a freshening. That was a...
I think the Malibu is better integrated on the inside. I really do. I think it just fits better on the inside. But I think from, you got that i4 with a 5-speed, it's actually not bad in the Fusion. You get in great fuel economy.
6-speed?
Almost can't beat it.
Yeah. But you look at the design of the Malibu. It's a striking car. Right?
Yeah.
Design subjective, but it's a tasteful, striking design that no one's really going to hate, and it's still really good.
Well, I know what you're saying.
The Camry's the Camry, right. Just reputation. Accord's got all those loyal Honda buyers. The Mazda 6 is a terrific car. It's my favorite in the class. If I were going to buy something, a midsize sedan, it's probably the one I'd get. But, the Fusion just sort of, it's a good car, just kind of leaves me cold. I mean, it's one of these that, you got to look at it because it's a good car, but... I wouldn't put it in my final two if I were going to pick in that segment.
But something's working, and I know what your point is, because, Malibu was car of the year for, I'm on the North American car of the year jury, and we all did it, but so did a whole bunch of other publications, and then Ford does this nice refresh and blows right past them.
Well, make no mistake, when I say I'm pessimistic about GM, I'm not pessimistic about their design or engineering. They do have, let's tick off their vehicles that are outstanding right now, the CTS, CTS-V, the Buick Enclave, the Malibu, the new Equinox, which is quite stunning.
In fact, really, you're talking all the architectures, not just those single models.
Yeah, all the architectures.
SRX, I think, looks really cool.
The new SRX. Yep. They've got, but there's something, they don't have enough time. They need the economy to really turn around, to gain some traction.
I'll tell you what else they need. They need a win. They need something that they need something that is gonna put up this big huge fan to blow away the wafting stench of bankruptcy and government ownership.
and I think unfortunately Camaro's not gonna be quite enough.
Camaro's one of them. I should have mentioned Camaro.
And actually, the new LaCrosse is...
The new LaCrosse. What I'm saying is it's all
there.
There's
no lack of product. There's no lack of product
disconnect. If I'm reading you right, or maybe I'm reading my interpretation of GM into what you're saying, is there's a disconnect with the top management and the management of the corporation versus coming out with good cars and trucks.
Yeah, because they're perfectly capable of doing great stuff. You're seeing it on the road.
Right.
But there's just this disconnect going on, and they need the economy to turn around. They need to gain traction. And, I don't know if they have enough time, before it becomes a real problem. And I think Big Ed, when he said, we're going to do 20%, I need to see some progress, that was just giving him an open book to say, look, if I want to yank Fritz out at the end of this year, mm-hmm. That's my...
Well, what I've been told is basically Fritz has till the end of the year to win over the board. Now, that doesn't mean on January 1st he's out, but what it means is if they don't start to see some signs that the company's getting traction, then maybe they start to consider...
Other options.
Is he the right guy? And then they have to... The other thing is you have a search for the CEO of GM. The number of people qualified to do that job, it's pretty rarefied air. And
I don't know. They found Ed Whitaker awfully damn quick. I think there's
But he's a non-executive chairman, and he's not living here in Detroit managing day-to-day. It's a different... he's extremely active.
Point.
He strays well outside the boardroom, obviously, but he doesn't live here. I don't think he comes here every week.
I think there's only one choice for the board, and that's to name the auto extremist the new chairman of GM.
I'll vote for that. In fact, I'll buy some GM shares to vote for you.
Just give me 12 months.
What do you make of the whole Roger Penske thing and the collapse of Saturn, Michael? What a shockeroo that was.
It was funny. I was with my wife on the way to a soccer game where my son was playing, and I'm just checking through my email, and I said, this email's got to be wrong. There's a wrong title because it said that it didn't go through. And then I called somebody, and they said, oh, yeah, it didn't go through. And I'm like, I can't believe it. How does this fall apart the afternoon before it's supposed to? I mean, basically everything was all lined up, and you almost stand back and look at it, and you wonder, you just wonder about what was really going on over in France in terms of how all this.
I think Roger and Carlos had a deal, and they didn't really. It never occurred to them that
they might need board approval.
Like we said last week, they were planning. You know, Joe Ajak and Roger were planning a roadshow with the dealers that was supposed to start
this week.
Yeah, right. So, you know, they were going to start this 9-city tour, I think, starting in San Francisco. You know, people talked about the Opel Magna deal when GM's board took a pass on it, and they ended up signing that deal a month later as a slap to Henderson. So here's Carlos Ghosn, who's, you know, the turnaround man of the industry, this omnipotent CEO of the company, and he's got a deal, and the board says no. I mean, that's what it looks like anyway. I mean, you know, it looks like the board just kind of said, hey, you know, we're going to be setting up this great retail network to compete against Nissan with Renault Samsung cars
right,
in the U.S.
Right, Korean.
And you know, so low-cost base coming to the U.S. with a great retail network of terrific dealers run by the best operator around. Hey, that's a tough combination.
Yeah, and Hyundai, Kia has already passed Nissan, right, in this market?
If you add up both their shares, they're either there or just over.
So they're probably looking at their watches saying, maybe this isn't a good idea.
Well, Nissan's sort of holding their ground in terms of market share right now. But I think they've got some problems going forward.
But the inexorable march forward of Hyundai Kia in this market is stunning.
Yeah. It really is, and they've got the right product. And I think one of the smartest things they never did was get in the pickup truck market.
Yeah.
Because I think Nissan has shown everybody, if you don't have scale, you're going to have major issues. Well, Toyota's got a little bit more scale, but I agree. And now Nissan's at a point where they don't know what they're going to do. You know, they can't keep going with the Titan, but yet they're going to have to find something to replace it. If they want to replace it or just let it die, I mean, it's a huge decision
to
make.
Don't you think they'd revive the deal with Chrysler or should revive the deal with Chrysler
if they want to stay
in that segment?
I'm sure, you know, our thought at our place is that, you know, they would look at the Mexican facility in Saltillo and basically say, we'll take that facility, we'll take the vehicle off your hands. But again, you know, the Fiat guys are talking about continuing to use Dakota, and maybe they still want Ram.
Why would the Fiat guys want to get rid of Ram? It's one of the few vehicles they have.
Over the next couple of years, there's really not a lot of product that's going to help keep the dealer base happy. I mean, it's minivans and Ram pickups, and you got a couple of Grand Cherokees eventually coming and some stuff out of Canada with Bramley. But past that, the midsize and the small car stuff obviously is really, really difficult for them right now.
Oh, do you think Chrysler can make it?
Our forecast has them very, very challenged. We think that there's some core platforms that eventually, you know, will eventually have a home like minivan, possibly Ram, maybe even Grand Cherokee. But, you know, the low end of their market is so challenged right now. And the other problem is that even if they look at getting together with somebody on D segment, you know, basically Sebring Avenger-sized vehicles, you need at least 500,000 units a year to make a go of it. I mean,
That's why it's got to be Fiat.
Well, I know, but Fiat, unfortunately, doesn't have any D volume. This is their problem. Mm-hmm. So what we're finding, actually, out of Europe is most the PSAs of the world and some of the others, they're using C-segment vehicles and stretching them up to D. But unfortunately, in this market, stretching a C to D is pretty challenging because people
Does Mantra have a D?
No, not really.
Tasis isn't a D?
No. Actually, it is, but it's so low volume and it's so old they can't even use it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because what I'm thinking here is, and this is kind of gets into the readily admitted wild speculation, but
which you're very good at, by the
right.
way. Yeah,
if
I'm putting all of this together, I'm thinking that long term. I mean, I don't think Chrysler is this whole unit with this whole lineup of vehicles that's really going to make it. I think Fiat keeps two Jeep plants, which is basically Jefferson Avenue for Grand Cherokee
and Toledo
for the Wrangler and four-door Wrangler. They keep a one or two Ram plants, definitely Mexico, right?
Yeah, but you get
one minivan plant.
The other problem is apparently the U.S. government is a major shareholder, so this is always
right now.
But who knows what's going to happen in the future? But right now, it's pretty difficult to get rid of a U.S. facility, or for that fact, a Canadian facility.
But they're going to have to. Well, okay. So those are the four plants I'm thinking that long term they keep that make Chrysler and Chrysler branded products. The small and mid-car plants start making Fiats and Alphas that they want to sell here. And basically, they just keep this handful of Chrysler products and use the dealer network and the plants to sell Fiat and Alpha cars. And if they maybe keep the Chrysler 300 platform and that plant and try to get some global scale for whatever launches, you know, they can do? Like, you're saying there's not enough volume to really marry them up.
Especially in front-wheel drive D car. I mean, what do they have right now? They have Sebring Avenger and the Journey down in Mexico. That's all off that main platform. You're lucky if you can scrub together 150,000 minutes on a good day.
But the basic problem is here we are talking about this and that plan and that plan. They got nothing yet.
Right.
Meanwhile, Ford's way down the road, and GM, even though there's a disconnect, they're way down the road in their products, and Chrysler, they're still deciding. And boy,
it just shows how much everything was starting to be dismantled under Daimler. Absolutely was devastated under Cerberus, and they lost maybe too much key competency.
Look, the only reason I think the Treasury Department saved Chrysler is because they figured if they let it go down, there'd be enough ripple through the supply base that it would hurt Ford and GM, obviously, and even some of the Toyota, Nissan, and Honda manufacturing in this country. I mean, that's the only reason that you save it, right?
That and the pensions. It's always nice to have somebody funding the pensions.
Other than apparently, PBGC,
It's unfortunate, and I think that, you know, a lot of people have said, including ourselves, they may still have too much capacity. They may have settled for way too much capacity. And Marchionne actually said it right the other day, and he's got 2 years. He really does have 2 years.
He also says he can make money in 2 years.
And frankly, being an old Chrysler man, I somehow hope he does, and that he can save the brand.
I think company to succeed around here. No one wants to see, you know, what is it, you know, 16 or 18,000 people they still have white-collar working there?
When is he coming down from the mountain with the tablets? Is that November?
November 4th.
Yeah. And then we'll know.
I love the way you put it there.
Oh, wait, he says he has 2 years, but they're coming up with a five-year plan.
Well, you got to think beyond 2 years.
Beyond 2 years, he's talking about Fiat North America.
But here's my whole question, you know, because up to now, up to this week, I believe Chrysler has the capability of turning it around. Whether they do or not is another issue, but they have the capability of doing it. But when I see people like Mike Accivetti getting blown out and Peter Fong getting blown out when they were just promoted to those positions 45 days ago, was it? Something like that. And, you know, if they were old-time stalwarts, been entrenched for a long time, and they blew them out, I go, okay, they were just put into those positions by Marchionne himself. What the hell happened there?
And then, you know, the explanation came from Marchionne's PR people as well. That's the way he works. If things aren't working out, he makes decisions quickly. And I'm just like, you know what? Doesn't really feel that way.
Well, when you go and blow out the decisions that you just made 6 weeks ago.
The confidence factor doesn't.
Either you made a big screw up then or you're making a big screw up now. Or maybe it was both times.
What's that do to morale in the organization?
It's got to destroy it. It hurt it badly, for sure. And so this week, for the first time, I finally went, these guys may not make it.
Well, I think that, you know, Marchionne got to spend maybe a little bit of time with these guys and maybe realize for what I envision for Dodge and for Chrysler, these aren't the right guys, and I may as well make a change now. I frankly don't know what went on, but I'm sure they've got to make decisions quickly. They can't wait 6 to 8 months and go down some road and then realize, oh my gosh, it's not the right road, and now we've already gone down it. We really don't have a lot of time to turn this around.
And Sergio at Frankfurt said, I was shocked at how bad things were, and I'm saying, really? I mean, you just entered into this deal and you're just realizing now how bad things were?
I think he was playing a little bit of a game with that, though.
Maybe.
I can't.
So that he
would be the third.
So he turns out to be a miracle worker if it all works out.
Sure, I guess you lower.
Lower expectations.
Ghosn took over Nissan. I mean, he went in there and gutted the place, and frankly, it already had a beating heart, so it was able to keep moving, and it grew on its own. He just more or less helped it. I think he had a little bit more time, though, than maybe Marchionne will, to tell you the truth.
So yeah. Well, I'm troubled though with the two guys that they put in their place because. It just seems more the same. And one I don't know at all, this Fred Diaz guy who's been out doing some regional work.
He came out of the region, yeah.
And Ralph Gilles I know a whole lot.
Sure.
And I think he's one of the absolute top design talents in the industry globally. But to give him a brand to run and continue to run.
Chief designer.
That's a lot to do.
I
just don't see it happening.
I hear the executives of Chrysler are already working crazy hours.
Yeah, they all are.
Yeah, and, well,
you know, but everybody's
this whole
always
businesses.
I know, but you know, the morale can't be good. You're working crazy hours trying to make this one of the sickest companies in the industry work, and then you could be fired 3 months after being promoted.
Yeah, but here, the problem I see is I'm not necessarily opposed to this idea of handling multiple jobs, but not in a crisis situation. And Chrysler is clearly in a crisis. And so how can Ralph really devote the right time? And the only thing that's going to pull Chrysler out of this is brilliant breakthrough product design.
That's the only thing that's worked for them in the last.
I would not have Ralph running this brand with this P&L responsibility that nobody, I don't think, over there really understands yet. And
they clearly got the idea from Lutz putting Brian Nesbitt in charge of Cadillac. I mean, they clearly got
it. I don't agree. I think it might have been Lutz got the idea from Marchionne, because this is the setup he did at Fiat back, 4 or 5 years ago?
I don't know, but I would have left Ralph right where he was.
I agree. Yeah, I think it's this is why I'm saying for the first time ever I'm going, company may not pull through.
You're wondering whether GM has the time or not. Does Chrysler have the time?
I mean, I don't think they do, but that's just me.
For the next couple of years.
I want them to survive. Everyone thinks I'm out for Chrysler. No, I want them to survive for this region, for this business. But, boy, it's just really grim right now.
Well, I've seen them pull a rabbit out of the hat twice in my career.
Yeah.
They did it.
Well, what's the rabbit here? What's the product?
You know,
there was a minivan. There was
that's
a PT
why I'm saying.
Cruiser.
That's why you don't let Ralph get distracted. You just say, make this design the best stuff ever. And you really have design, engineering, manufacturing, purchasing work together like they did under the platform organization, which was the second time they pulled a rabbit out of the hat.
I remember going to the 92 Detroit Auto Show and seeing the LHs. And I ran home and told my dad, I said, these things are going to rock and roll, Dad. I said, go buy Chrysler stock. And I did, and it did extremely well. You're right. They don't have that kind of groundbreaking product, at least not coming out this year, not coming out next year, that's really going to need them to drive more people into the showrooms to at least see some of the other stuff that they might be interested in. That's the problem.
Right.
So should we talk about the Equus and idea for resurrecting
going
the Saturn?
Going back to the Saturn story a bit. Yeah. Talk about that a bit, Peter.
Well, my thought was, here are these Saturn dealers. Not all 300 are stellar dealers. We were talking about that, but there's plenty of really good ones. Here's Hyundai with bringing the Equus in, the $65,000 sedan, which you've actually seen.
Yeah, driven it.
Yeah, briefly.
Briefly,
a five-minute. And I just thought, you know, the Saturn deal imploded. If I was John Krasick from Hyundai, I'd get the top 50 Saturn dealers or however many in Vegas and say, look, here's the deal. We can't bring the Equus into our Hyundai showrooms. And I said in my comm, because people would be tripping over the balloons to look at them, it just doesn't work. So we need a separate dealer organization, and we've got 16 months to do it.
In fact, you could have two cars, because they really should put the Genesis sedan in that line.
Yes. Yeah. And, and then I heard from an irate Saturn dealer who says, we're out of time, you're full of it, we can't do it. And I'm just like, you know what,
if there were books in front of you, you're not out
of
time.
Yeah, if there was a will, and there's a way.
You bet there is.
And if I was Hyundai, I would be doing that right now, because I don't think they can sell that car, even though they're talking 1,000 to 2,000 units initially of the Equus. I mean, who's kidding who? I mean, they're not going to stop there. So get us.
What's the price point going to be?
$65,000.
Is it that high? Because we were talking 70 once, and someone at Hyundai told me that it wasn't going to be that high. But it's going to be an expensive car for Hyundai.
So,
I don't think they can sell it.
Yeah.
They shouldn't
sell it. Get these top Saturn dealers and say, look, we'll get your signage. Here's
I think it's a very smart idea what you're saying there, because we know the Koreans have wanted to launch a luxury Hyundai. I shouldn't say the Koreans. Hyundai wanted to launch a luxury brand. But I guess what I'm saying is it was Korea that was really pushing for it.
They were premature, but now they're...
U.S. management was going, whoa, let's go down the checklist here of Hyundai stuff we got to fix first. But they want to do it, and Krafchik could really score some points back in Seoul if he said, hey, here's a way of getting in fast and cheap.
We should have Skyped him in tonight.
And these are small footprint dealers, usually in suburban locations. I mean, the locations in a lot of cases are fantastic locations. Small footprint, small showrooms. It'd be perfect.
Top 25 markets.
Right. And plus, these Saturn guys, I mean, they've got all this Saturn service work that's going to need to be done anyways. And you don't want to keep sending them to Chevy dealers. So, you know, that would keep them happy for a little while anyways, at least out the back door.
Yeah. They also know how to handle the customer service aspect of the dealership the way a luxury buyer is going to want.
Right.
It is a ready-made solution.
It's the only chance that Hyundai has to launch a new dealer network. You know, you're not talking about brick and mortar. It's already there. It's really the only quick solution because the Equus hits the market in December of 10, right? That's what I understand.
Yeah.
Let's patent that idea.
Yeah, really.
Trademark it. Copyright it. Do whatever it does. Well, you know, I'm fascinated by this whole idea of contract manufacturing. And I'm told when Roger went searching for companies, he quickly got a deal going with Carlos Ghosn because he knows Carlos, yada-da-da-da. I'm told companies were falling out of the woodwork wanting to build cars for him. And the only reason they can't pick it up, and maybe this is where it gets Machiavellian because the deal collapsed at the last second. But had this deal with Renault collapsed a couple of months ago, I think what I'm told is there's no question Roger would have picked somebody else up.
Oh, I think there's no doubt.
So much capacity around the world. People are falling all over themselves, and especially with a magic name like Roger Penske.
You look around, you know, PSA has wanted into this market for a long time, even though they publicly say no. But you know that deep down, maybe eventually finding a North American footprint to produce some of their vehicles and a ready-made distribution network. Probably, in our opinion, one of the best Chinese OEMs out there that is really up there in terms of technology and getting much better is SAIC. I mean, they've learned from GM and Volkswagen for years. They've taken some great lessons. They've done some fantastic things, and they're ready to, you know, they're ready to export. It was interesting at Frankfurt, no Chinese OEMs. Why? Government told them not to go. Government told them unless you've got a ready-made export plan, don't bother going to Frankfurt. It was very, very interesting. There were no Chinese OEMs there, bar none.
They reined them in.
Nothing.
Wow, because
nothing.
The last time I was at Frankfurt, there were at least five, maybe even six.
In my estimation, the world's only international auto show from here on out, and it may be too grandiose of an exclamation, is really Beijing or Shanghai. You have to be in Beijing or Shanghai, but you don't have to be in Frankfurt. You don't have to be in Detroit. You don't.
Nobody's
have to be
going
in Paris.
To Tokyo.
And Tokyo, Tokyo really has been a regional show for the last three or four shows, anyways.
Right.
It's more of a technology show for the Japanese.
Right.
So.
You don't think Detroit's an international show?
I think, in some respects, the fact that you've got major companies like Nissan bowing out.
They're back.
Well, they're back only through their Detroit dealer network from what
no,
we
No, that's
understand.
Not my understanding. I understand Nissan's back. Porsche's coming back. I mean, look.
For DADA's hope, I hope that's true. But from what I understood, Nissan was back mainly through their Detroit dealer network.
Well, the dealer network had tried to do their own display last year, and then
right.
the factory forbade them
right.
from exhibiting anything. No, I'll check it out, but I was told that Nissan was back, Porsche was back, and...
Yeah, because Porsche found that they didn't get enough attention in L.A.
Right. Because the international media does not come in to any show in North America except for Detroit, really, in any big number.
And so they're going to have the big Panamera blowout in Detroit.
Well, you know...
Well, in L.A., too, but...
Sure. Oh, you know, you got to do it in L.A., too. But what do you make of this idea of a whole new business model like Roger Penske's tried to crack? Smart hasn't quite done it, but I think that's a product.
Basically, you're just a retailer.
Yeah.
You have
yeah.
no manufacturing.
Right.
No engineering, no design, just you're a retailer.
I think it was smart to try and stick, well, maybe not in retrospect, it wasn't as smart, but to try and stick with one OEM so that you had, you know, one channel to get all your parts, one channel to work with the design and the development people. If you start dealing with two or three different manufacturers building different vehicles for you, now that's where it gets haywire. Everybody's got different development
yeah.
routines, and you bring all these different types of parts. There's no synergy between the parts in the parts bay. That gets a lot more problematic. I like the idea.
Taking this idea like the electronics companies have? And so, yeah, early on right now, you got to take what anybody is building.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if Apple wants to do the iPhone, it designs it the way it wants and then contracts it out.
Sure.
What do you think about it going that way?
Well, I think most global OEMs are raising their game. Even the Chinese and Indian OEMs are raising their game very, very quickly. They're not all quite there, but they're moving up very, very quickly. And I think that, you know, over the next 10 years, there will not be a significant amount of difference, at least at the mass market, between a lot of platforms. So it's going to start to come down to brand, powertrain technology, fuel economy. But frankly, everybody's raising their game. The Chinese have done a great job. They've gone out and get to work with tier ones, major tier ones that bring the technology. They didn't invent a lot of it in China. They brought it in. Now they're getting a lot smarter about using it, and they're getting ready to export. Their market's too strong right now to think about export, but eventually it'll happen.
Absolutely.
But other than SAIC, are there Chinese automakers whose quality and technology and engineering is good enough to send to mature Western markets?
I think FAW is maybe a car or two away, but we got to be careful. We can't think that all these vehicles are going to be absolute top quality, top technology. I think that they're going to be basically almost where the Koreans were 10 or 15 years ago, and then they're going to work their way up. But they're going to work their way up very, very quickly. And I think I call it kind of the half-life. The Japanese took about 25 years to figure out how to do it. Koreans maybe about 15 years to figure out how to do it. I think the Chinese will do it in less than 10. Mm. I really do. When you go to China and you see how quickly they're moving up the ladder, is absolutely unbelievable.
JVs with everybody, so they get
the technology. Yeah, they're learning very quickly, and it's the right mode to do it.
So what about continuing this idea of contract manufacturing? What about spinning off powertrain altogether? I mean, if GM, Ford, and Chrysler or GM and Ford really want to save a ton of money, I'm talking billions, fast, why not say, let's combine our powertrain operations? We'll use software to differentiate the driving characteristics. Certain things we will not combine. Maybe we keep our special build shop as GM in, Wixom there, and we'll special build engines like Corvette and stuff like that. I mean, couldn't you save a ton of money real fast?
You could. I think one of the problems you're going to run into, well, actually, if you think about transmissions, Ford and GM have really already done that in both rear drive and front drive. It's worked very well for them. They get scale. Ford gets access. Let's face it, GM in their transmission technology is one of the best in the world. Quietly, you know, there's a reason why Rolls-Royce used them for years and years and years. They're one of the best hydromatic transmissions. I think Ford knew that and realized maybe we're not quite as good at this. Let's get some scale and get together with these guys. Could it happen in the engine side? I think it's already happening, especially in diesels over in Europe. There's a lot of sharing going on. I think you need scale, but it's really the technology. And that's where, if you don't have the technology, you're going to have to find a friend pretty quickly, because the fuel economy standards are getting stiffer, the emission standards are getting stiffer, and if you're not ready, which we see with Chrysler was a major issue, you had better move up the curve real quick.
Peter, could you do that? Combine engines, different companies? Do you think it would matter to most buyers?
I think you'd have to be very careful, depending on the brands. And diesels, you know, truck diesels, you know, that might be one thing. But, you know, I think once you get to a certain strata of car and prestige, I don't think you want to do too much engine sharing. People want to know that that's an Audi, you know, turbo diesel with Le Mans winning heritage, or that's the BMW famous motor, or Porsche. You know, there's probably a level where you have to say, okay, we can't do that now.
I remember, you know, and this is an old example, but when GM started sharing engines between the divisions, consumers, you know, didn't like it.
General Motors got sued when it started putting Chevrolet engines
that was
in Oldsmobile.
79, 78, it was just
79.
When my dad was retiring, it was just like this huge grenade, the bomb that went off, and I remember that. It was just like, wow.
Well, I remember one of GM's presidents, I can't remember who it was at the time, maybe Pete Estes, saying that he didn't know what the big deal was until at a board meeting some guy got up and said, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted a Rocket 88. I wanted an Oldsmobile with a Rocket 88. This was everything that I wanted. And when I finally was able to get enough money together and finally buy one of your cars new, I opened up the engine compartment. It's a Chevy in there.
And remember, too, that GM was, all the industry was famous for the color, the paint color on their engines.
Sure.
And, you know, Chevy engines were red, Pontiacs were blue, Cadillac, I forget, were they dark blue or black or something, but there was always this distinctiveness going
on. But today, that concept is like old-fashioned.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I'm saying, you know, we keep marching
along. I mean, you know, Honda files love their Honda engines, and same with BMW people, and, you know, the GM small block V8s still have a following. The total car, between the design, the interior, the brand itself, the engine, I mean, it's still a package that everybody has to pull together and reach the consumer.
I agree totally to that.
But if you're contracting all this stuff out,
it's all computer controlled. And the true differentiation, the true calibration, the mending or melding, I should say, of engine and transmission and throttle response and blah, 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 all that stuff, it's in the software now. That's where you get the real differentiation.
Well, especially if we get to the shiny, happy, smiley car stage, where the only differentiator will be design.
How many hamsters are in the
design. Yeah. Design will be even more prominent because, you know, there'll be a lot of underneath there. You know, like you said, it's all programmed, and half the buyers don't care anyway as long as it...
I don't know. I think we're seeing such a technology revolution right now, even with internal combustion engines in terms of direct injection and HCCI and all this other stuff. And who gets the edge is the one who perfects some of these things or wrings a few extra miles per gallon out of it while still giving you the horsepower. There's still an edge to be gained in the marketplace by
innovation,
engineering a better powertrain,
innovation
to the point where it's not. I don't think it is just software. I think there's a lot more to it than that.
Oh, don't get me wrong. There absolutely is. But you know, when you go after a given market segment, let's just say in four-cylinder engines, you all start going for the same solution. You start doing the same sort of things to get to that same solution. It gets very, very similar. So I'm just positing that. As this industry changes, this whole contract manufacturing, Roger Penske trying a whole new business model, I mean, to me, it would be a no-brainer for GM and Ford to get together and say, look, we did this transmission thing. Let's do an engine together, and let's put a strategy so we cut the cost in half on everything.
As an observer, one of the real kind of shameful things here about the Penske deal not going through is that it would be interesting to see how this works. We have one company that's basically just a sales and marketing organization taking somebody else's products and selling it. Because I think right now there's still, particularly with the domestics, there's too big of a disconnect between the company and the consumer because you have the dealer in the middle. And I don't think enough of the... In the case of Toyota and Honda, the feedback does go from the consumer and dealer to the company because Toyota actually sends engineers out to talk to dealers. And I was talking to a dealer in Ohio who had a Toyota engineer come in from Nagoya just to talk to him about tires, to find out what tires should be on various models, get feedback from him. I don't think the domestics are doing that. So then you're going to take this other model where the guys who are engineering and designing and manufacturing the cars have nothing to do with the dealer except they're just heaving their production over to the guy and he's going to do it. You know, it's just another disconnect between consumer and company that makes the car.
You know, David was talking about the ICE, the internal combustion engine. There's still a lot of room. I mean, I think there's still, I think there's, you know, you talk to a lot of granola crunchers out there and they'll say that the ICE is dead.
No,
because of all these electric cars.
Well, after going to Frankfurt, it even proved to me even more that
a lot of window dressing, of EV stuff.
I mean, frankly, you go to the Renault stand and they had four electric vehicles and not hybrids. I mean, there was not a gasoline or diesel engine to be found in any of these vehicles. But we got to face facts. I mean, your average lithium battery, we figure at CSM, we figure it's probably between 800 and 1,000 euro per kilowatt hour. Something like that, at least at current levels.
So what does that mean?
You need about 15 kilowatt to 20 kilowatt hours, kilowatt battery, to drive most of these vehicles. You're talking about a $15,000 or $20,000 battery. Well, that's apparently fairly expensive. Your average internal combustion engine, you can shove it in the bay for less than $500 a lot of times.
Well, the target that I've been told is about $500 a kilowatt. So you're you're still, for a lot of the EVs and plug-in hybrids, still talking about batteries that cost $8,000 or $9,000.
Well, the ICE has so much more to go. I mean, you talk to any of these engineers at these companies, they said we got a long way to go with that.
You know, the point I keep making is
you know, we talk about Ford having momentum. You know, the EcoBoost is not only a really good engine, but it's also a bit of a brand name for them now. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to share this with everybody.
Well, one of the most masterful things Ford did, I mean, let's face it, direct injection and turbocharging is out there. Everybody has it.
Volkswagen's been doing EcoBoost for years.
Sure, and, you know, let's talk about the Corvair turbos and the, you know. But they branded it, and it's worked out wonderfully for them.
Right. And what's also interesting is just not only how they've deployed it, and they're deploying it globally too. In a lot of respects, Europe is using a lot of the same ideas. Global platforms get a lot of scale. The other thing that came true is, or it really came out, is when electric vehicles do eventually come, and they will. We'll get the price down, but it's not going to be tomorrow, and it's not going to be even 10 years from now, but it will. The whole idea of a platform changes. We don't need a big lump in front of the driver anymore. There's no such thing as an engine.
Think about what that'll do for design.
Oh, my God. It'll just open up the possibility many, many ways. You'll have electric motors. You'll have hub motors.
Well, like Audi showed with the...
Exactly.
Except they blew the front end.
I think they will.
Eventually. It's just like, okay, you've been pounding those...
Bell design.
Yeah, you've been pounding those rings down our throats for 30 years, and then you show this electric R8, and there's just like this aluminum grill, barbecue grill on the front. I was just like, what are you guys doing?
You know, it was also interesting at Frankfurt. One of the best powertrain technologies was shown by Fiat. They had an infinitely variable intake valve. It was basically...
Is this multi-air? Multi-air?
Yeah. Multi-jet or multi-air or something.
Yeah, multi-air.
And they showed it at Geneva, but it's really fantastic technology.
No, it's really good. You see, everybody's been trying to do solenoid valve openings for years. I saw stuff like this at Ford.
Aura tried it, I remember, 10 years ago at Aura, and that clickety-clack used to just drive you nuts.
Right. Well, it was not only that, but it took so much energy to drive. So what Fiat said is, look, we've got variable valve timing right now anyway. Let's combine hydraulic with solenoid. And we'll use the solenoid to adjust the hydraulic actuator. It's really kind of a cool idea. And, they're going to be bolting this on all the Chrysler engines.
They can change the torque curve on all these engines. They can get better fuel economy when they want to. It really is a great idea.
Which means the ICE's got a long way to go.
It does. And I think anybody who thinks that we're all going to be driving around battery-powered electric vehicles all over the place is foolish.
It's only going to be
There are exactly, a little more than, I shouldn't say exactly, there are a little more than 700 EVs on the road. That's what Tesla's doing.
It's only going to be a percentage of the global fleet.
It's true.
Right.
Well, and you know what? Most of that's going to be for probably the next 5+ years. They're going to be commercial fleets in Europe and Asia. That's where they're being purchased. It's for the postal fleets, governments, municipalities in big cities like Tokyo and Denmark, aren't they buying a bunch of EVs in Copenhagen or something like that? That's where most of the sales are going to be. It's not going to be the average guy in the street, even one who has a lot of money. I mean, when I talked about Tesla's 700-plus cars, I forgot about the Mini E's.
Yeah.
And there are how many Mini E's being leased out there?
50, wasn't it?
For $900 a month.
Yeah. You know, a little bit of folklore. The very first electric Mini were the vehicles that they used on the Italian job when they went into the subway. The producer said that they wouldn't actually let a gasoline engine car start down there, so they had to make 3 electric Minis to actually do the shoot.
Really?
So the very first electric Mini was actually for the Italian job about 4 or 5 years
ago.
The original one, yeah.
That's great. Hey, but enough of us gabbing. Let's get to what our viewers want to ask and comment about. Ben, let's run the graphic. Time for rapid fire.
This is a great graphic.
Okay, so Michael, just so you know that we're getting questions and comments and that for the viewers, we try to answer this in about a minute or so. Ben will start running a graphic of what looks like a fuel gauge, and as you go on and on with your answer, the low fuel warning and then the out of gas ones.
Or we get sick of them and do them in 10 seconds.
Yeah, right. Okay, comment from Jeremy Jones. Any thoughts on the new 4Runner? I don't know anything about the new 4Runner. Michael, what do you know?
I haven't seen it in the flesh yet. As far as I know, I think it's going unibody, but past that, I don't know much about it.
Okay. Michael Weber says, what Lulliet said after the show about suppliers was spine-chilling. I'd never heard about the 30% bailout interest or the quiet cull by OEs. That's sort of a comment. You know, there was government money for suppliers to get, but what Tim Lulliet pointed out is it was a 3% interest rate per month, so over 30%. And so as they were railing against the credit card companies for usury rates, they were imposing that on the suppliers. Kind of interesting. Okay, Pedro Fernandez wants to know, if all you guys could put together enough resources, would you acquire Saturn? And if so, where would the vehicles come from?
No.
No. No.
Well, you're taking 50 of their dealers and
I'm going somewhere else.
To Hyundai.
I'm going to sell the Renzo sports car.
Well, I would take it because I'm intrigued. I got this from a very good source that Roger had multiple car companies he could have turned to. And maybe the Saturn deal, if somebody comes up with money.
I like the PSA idea because they got some very cool cars.
They've got some cool cars, but unfortunately they build them all in Euro and they cost a bloody fortune to bring them over. So they got to find a North American footprint.
It'd be so cool to see some of those.
Who's one of their best friends? Mitsubishi. Yeah. And apparently with a plant that gets about 10% capacity utilization out of their Illinois facility. So there are a lot of natural affiliations.
There's a lot of possibilities.
There are a lot of possibilities. And you look at PSA, God love them, but they were doing so well in the European market. Well, obviously, this is rapid fire, so I better keep going.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
you catch on.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I got it. I got it.
Caddy Daddy says, how much does the decline in auto sales mean when the domestics are trying to move from a push to a pull program? Wouldn't they rather sell fewer cars for more money?
Of course they would, but I mean, this is such a tough market. They're trying to get as much, you know, produced in their plants to keep the workers they have remaining, you know, working and make some money. It's always that balancing act. You know, how much do you spend to move the metal, and how much is left over in profit?
We've also got the dealer side, too. I mean, they cut a lot of dealers, but they still want to try and make them as happy as they can, the ones they've got left. So throughput through the front door can always help them out the back door as well.
Well, I agree with David. You know, anybody will take any sale they can get right now. When times are good, they're going to want to go to a pull system. And I would say, again, I keep harping on this, we've taken out enough capacity, gotten rid of the jobs bank. You don't have to build cars just to build cars. You can build them to customer demand. So.
Yeah, and right now, you know, do you want to cut too deep and then you don't have enough production when things finally do turn?
Well, that's what third shifts are all about. So
George says, Cadillac released some photos of the CTS Coupe a year and a half ago, which is a stunner. Do you agree? But they released the low-volume wagon before the coupe. Why? Peter, you want to take that?
Well, the wagon was done. And
there's a good reason.
Yeah, it was ready. The CTS Coupe is sensational.
Yeah.
It's out. They've moved it up, which we've heard.
Come sooner.
It's coming in late spring now, and which is before it was coming next August. It's a stunning car, and the V version is just going to be just drop dead.
It was the car of the show a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no.
The CTS wagon out front.
I do. I'm driving, test driving that right
it's
now.
It's nice.
It's a very nice car. It's a very nice car.
I think
car.
It looks great.
It's a great design.
But I don't entirely agree. But why would they do a wagon? I mean, what are they going to sell, 7,000 of these things?
Well, they're probably thinking abroad. At one point when they wanted to make this a global brand, they were thinking, well, a wagon might help us, especially over in Europe.
They still
want
to make it a global
brand. Yeah, and so all the development was done. So
well, Europe's not part of the equation, I can assure you that. I mean, not a major part anyway.
So the work was done, so they had to bring it up first.
Yeah. Okay, Wright Knight says, let Saturn survive using GM's Holden as a base.
No.
One can dream.
Well, a lot of people don't know is Holden basically is one or two cars, and they're all larger cars, and Saturn really needs smaller stuff, too.
I need to call BS on something here, and that's how much equity the Saturn brand has and how great it is. I just don't buy it. You know, people have been telling me in this town for, you know, the past couple of years that Saturn and Hummer are great brands. I disagree. I think Hummer's been beaten up by the environmentalists. I mean, it's got some cachet with a certain group. Saturn... You know, I did a story on this a while ago. When they clinicked the Aura on this 4-point scale of clinicking, like a college grade point average, no badges on it, nothing, just Saturn Aura. It was a 3-4, one of the best cars they ever clinicked. Put the Saturn Aura names on it, it was a 2.0. It's a lot of baggage. I just don't buy it.
Wow, such a downer.
Okay, Max wants to know, do you think an affordable mid-engine car will ever be built again, like the Fiero or MR2?
No.
Why not?
Because I think if they're going to do an affordable car, it won't be mid-engine. They will use the mid-engine car as a design leader, a statement car. They will never do an affordable one. It's just not. There's no economies of scale. There's nothing. They won't do it.
That would be niche.
Mid-engine cars, fabulous on the track, suck for everyday driving in terms of having to carry stuff, no luggage space, blah, 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 blah.
Other toys.
Okay, let's see. John Wills, hello, John.
John.
Says, what about Delphi coming out of bankruptcy? Get ready for the next 100 years?
It's a much slimmer Delphi, and they're focusing on many, many fewer technologies. I think just the ones that they think
power
can go forward.
Isn't that what they're primarily focusing on? Some electronic stuff?
For the most part,
It's real sad to see how that place just sort of imploded. It's unreal. You know, I was reading this week that they have 14,000 employees in the United States now. When they were spun off of General Motors, they had over 180,000. I want to say like 187,000.
Wow.
And the vast majority of those were in the United States. So they're down to 14,000. Wow. Now, that gives you a scale.
Well, it's devastation that's gone on, yeah.
Right. Comment from Rojo Venom. Now that the Chevy Caprice is back, what will be the Crown Vic's replacement?
That's a problem.
Well, Ford doesn't really have anything in the rear drive area that they're going to be revamping. So if it's going to come, it's going to come off a larger sort of Taurus size type of platform. You know, it's a good business for them right now. But for instance, that facility where they build it in St. Thomas, Ontario, that's been basically building the same type of vehicle for 35 years. And it may seem mean, but for the most part, they've updated the paint shop, and that's about it.
Oh.
So you basically would have to completely implode the place and rebuild it. And Ford may also stand back and say, how valuable is this business going forward? We've seen police vehicles move in all kinds of different directions. We've seen Tahoes and Chargers and all kinds of types of vehicles.
There's going to be a Caprice police package.
Right, right.
But also, I think you're not being fair to St. Thomas. I think they did paint the smoker's lounge.
God love those Canadians. But.
So this is my question to you then. Ford and the CAW in negotiations now. CAW says, we're not going to give you concessions until we get employment guarantees. Ford says, we're not going to give you employment guarantees until we get concessions. Could it be over the St. Thomas plan?
I think St. Thomas is a major issue, but I think if Ken Lawenza really reads the tea leaves, and he probably has, he knows that he needs to put all his eggs into Oakville, where they're building the Flex and the MKT and the Edge and the like. That's where Ford's future in Canada will be. But also they've got some powertrain plants down in Windsor. If he focuses on those two, that's where he should focus.
Okay, comment from JW. Can the Autoline team address the over-optimism of Chrysler's forecasted volumes that they're projecting? Scorpion engine program at 860,000 a year? Can someone pinch them in their dreams?
This is an ongoing issue with a lot of vehicle manufacturers, not only the domestics, but even we're starting to see a little bit out of the Japanese, where they're getting a little bit more grandiose in their volumes. I think everybody, you know, David and Peter, everybody understands that you need to have higher volumes to justify the return on investment. And obviously, the OEMs are going to drive those higher volumes, tell their suppliers those higher volumes so they can get the part costs down. We're telling suppliers, be very, very careful about risk in the future. Assess your risk. Make sure that you're on core, highly stable programs. I'll take lower volume if it's more stable, because it won't wreak havoc with your manufacturing facilities.
Well, Chrysler's, they're having some suppliers turn them away, right, because of the risk.
And it'll be a technology problem, and I think they're already starting to see that.
Okay, when will the U.S. market be considered back? Is it a 12 million SAR, 14, 16?
I think it'll be probably between 14 and 15.
I agree.
I was thinking 15 minimum, but we're all in the same range.
Yeah.
It's 15 million.
How soon do we hit 14 then?
We think that 14 is probably attainable by the end, in terms of a pace, by the end of 11, maybe into 12.
Oh, that's,
do you think we'll hit 14 for full year 12?
No, not 12, 14 full year probably, but not 2011. It'll probably be below
14. What do you think the real size of the market is? You know, we were up around 17 for a while.
Yeah, pushing a lot of volume. We shouldn't have people driving Durangos. And
probably right around 14 and a half, 15.
That's exactly what I think. I was talking to Gary Diltz at J.D. Power, and they did some modeling on this, and they said that 2 million units a year was basically very aggressive lease deals, fleet, and, you know, home equity or you know, incentive-based stuff. You know, it was all junk.
Okay, last, more of a comment question here. You mentioned that GM has three times more orders for the new GMC Terrain than it can produce. I also remember hearing a report that Suzuki has sold a ridiculously small number of Grand Vitaras. Aren't they essentially the same vehicles? Terrain and Vitara?
Grand Vitara is all done. That's a done deal. So they're just building the Equinox and the Terrain up in Canada at CAMI.
And so. He goes on to say, this is Phil Hopewell, is the new Equinox Terrain a warmed-over version of the old Equinox Vitara or a totally new design?
It's a very, very nice vehicle.
Yeah.
And the fuel economy is fantastic on it.
Yeah.
That size of vehicle, GM really pulled a rabbit out of the hat.
They hit the ball out of the park with this one from an engineering
perspective. Yeah, they absolutely did. And everyone says, well, the new SRX is the same car underneath. No, it's a whole different car with that.
Well, it's the same architecture.
But it's a super sophisticated all-wheel drive system from Saab.
It's a longer wheelbase.
Yeah.
It's, they're
looking at production for the Terrain and Equinox, right?
They're talking about a third shift up at CAMI.
Yes,
and I think it's sustainable.
Yeah,
they completely control CAMI now?
Yeah, it's half owned by Suzuki and GM, but for the most part, it's GM's facility. So Suzuki would be crazy not to let them build more and get royalties off it. So, frankly,
just buy it from them.
I think the word of mouth on those vehicles is going to be strong.
Yeah. I agree. And like I said, that SRX, it looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know? I like the styling.
It's been right sized.
Yeah.
It's exactly what has happened to that vehicle.
Well, look, we're at the top of the hour, and we ought to wrap it all up here, but this has been a great discussion. And, Michael, great having you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll have you back at some point. David, great having you here, as always,
always
too.
Always a pleasure.
And, Peter, good having you here, Mr. AutoExtremist.com.
.gov.
That's right. I'm not going to be here next week. Tomorrow night, I'm flying out of town. I'm taking a two-week vacation, but Peter will be here hosting the show.
You're on vacation as often as Johnny Carson was.
Boy, I wish, man. I would.
You like the guest host a lot better.
Oh, my God.
You are correct, sir.
We have a number of people filling in for me while I'm gone. Jim Hall will be in from 2953 Analytics. Kate Limbaugh from The Wall Street Journal. Rod Maloney from WDIV Channel 4 in Detroit. Murray Feldman from Channel 2 in Detroit. Christy Schweinsberg from WardsAuto.com. Who am I missing, Chip? Or is
Frank
that?
Marcus.
And Frank Marcus from Motor Trend. So you'll be watching them for the next 2 weeks. I'll be on for tomorrow, of course, but then I just got to get away. And then the 29th of the month, Peter did a great job, and he's got Mark Royce coming on the show then. And that's going to be a great show. You'll definitely want to tune into that. Remember what I said at the top of the show. We want AutoLine Daily, and I know a lot of you watching now or listening now know about AutoLine Daily. We want to win a podcast award. So if you do us a favor, go to podcastawards.com, and you got to enter us in the business category, and we're asked, what's the name of the show? The name of the show is AutoLine Daily. And they'll also ask for the URL, and what you have to put is autolinedaily.com. And if you do that, we'll love you for it. Can always follow us in a bunch of other areas. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/autolinedetroit, twitter.com/autoline. You can find Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist. Go to Business Week to find David's stuff, right?
Sure. And check out the AutoBeat blog.
Okay. Good. And Michael?
We're at csmauto.com.
csmauto.com. Okay. You don't have any blog or Facebook or Twitter?
No, I'm busy enough.
My son's going to be sick of it. Working on any big projects or something like that?
In fact, I leave Sunday for Beijing. I'm going to speak at World Steel Conference. I can't believe they're still having global conferences these days, but they are.
What are you going to talk about?
Kind of the new norms of the industry, the structural changes, and the fact that we kind of left our grandfather's industry behind us, and it really is going to be a lot different in the future. So I'm talking about how it's going to be different.
Steelmakers.
Well, to steelmakers, the older material, but they keep talking about high-strength steels, which actually is are a good alternative for the OEMs, rather than going to aluminum or magnesium in some cases.
I think
cases
there's a lot of life. Like we were talking about with the ICE engine, there's a lot of life.
There is.
We're going to need more high-strength steels as we get to more direct injection and higher compression engines, right?
It's in the future.
He's talking more of the body.
I'm talking more
talking body applications.
I'm talking
okay.
more, but if you think about it, Americans are. You know, if you look at myself, I'm not getting any thinner. So Americans are not getting any thinner. Thank you. But Americans aren't getting any thinner. We're not going to want our cars out much smaller. No. So if they do get a little bit smaller, we're going to be getting better fuel economy in the powertrain area and making vehicles lighter. It isn't rocket science how we're going to have to get better fuel.
We know in this country we pretty much abandoned basic steel research for damn near 50 years. And it's only through, what is it?
ALSAB and a couple of those
ALSAB
other initiatives.
ALSAB and some of the national labs are starting right. to do. National Center for Manufacturing Sciences is putting a lot of money into basic steel research again. And you start doing nano stuff and doing combination.
Sure.
Composite with steel. I think there's a lot of life left in steel, and a lot of lightweight structures that come out of it.
There is, and then I fly to Bangkok. I'm going to Bangkok for all of 2 days to go see what's going on down there. But
what kind of auto stuff is down there? Is this
actually, Thailand is Toyota, and Toyota is Thailand. I mean, they are far and away the biggest market leader down there in trucks, and they build some cars
there's
down there too.
Big compact pickup market. That's
oh, right. It's huge.
Yeah,
it's
second
huge.
Only to the United States in production and sales, I believe.
Yeah. Actually, the big thing in the industry these days is a lot of the OEMs are trying to find a way, like Ford did with the Transit Connect, around the chicken tax. Mm-hmm. And both my sons know what the chicken tax is because I explained to them the whole idea about it and how it came about. But there are OEMs that are working day and night trying to figure a way around that stupid tariff. UAW may not think it's stupid, but it is stupid. Anything 25% on one type of vehicle doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Right, so. And there's been a lot of shenanigans over the years of how to get around that. The yeah. Subaru Brat being my favorite example. You know, where they stuck seats in the bed of the little
pickup. Let's put a lawn chair back there is basically what they did.
Yeah, I know it's something I wanted to ask you about. What about the concept of super low-cost cars? Tata says it's going to bring the Nano to
I
the
I sat in a Nano when I went to India 3 weeks ago.
Yeah,
and so what was funny is...
It looks cool to me.
Actually, there was a lot of space inside. I was floored. I sat in the back. I rolled the window down, put my shoulder or my arm out the rear door. It was fantastic. I shouldn't say fantastic, but in terms of the amount of space inside. So I started asking some questions. I said, first of all, as you know, there's no lift gate on this vehicle, none whatsoever. So if you want to get into the back, you have to go in through the side door, flip the seat forward, and put something on the shelf which holds the engine, basically. To get in the engine, you got to undo wing nuts. So to actually get in,
really?
Change, to check the oil, you got to undo wing nuts, which was unbelievable. But the best part was I'm sitting in the back, and the passenger seat's in front of me, and I look down. You got to be kidding. The battery's sitting there with the cables, and if some little kid could take his fingers and just, you know, kind of play with it, and I'm thinking to myself,
you're kidding me.
I'm not joking. The battery's under the passenger seat. I think I said, this can't be. He goes, oh, yeah, that's where the battery is. I said, don't you put something around it? Oh, no, that's the way it comes. It's like, oh, you got to be kidding. I mean, how much of a cost?
It's more on the outside than that.
Oh, on the inside, it's super, super crude, I'm telling you.
Did Monroe and Associates do some work on that?
Oh, yeah. Sandy Monroe did a lot of design work.
I know Sandy well. I can't believe he'd let them have exposed battery connectors under the passenger
seat. I'm looking at it. I'm at the dealership, and it's an exposed battery sitting underneath the passenger seat.
How do they bring that car to this country?
They're not going to bring it.
They can't.
That's what I
There's
think.
No way. I mean,
it would be they'd have to highly modify it.
Community kind of, you know, neighborhood vehicle thing.
I'd rather buy a gem if I'm going to do that. I wouldn't bother with a Nano.
And then to upgrade it for American taste. I was told about $3,000 in cost to upgrade it, not only for safety, but just to make it acceptable.
Okay, so now you're at $5,500. I was talking with this guy from Wuling. They're doing their own sedan now, you know, finally breaking out of just commercial vehicles. And he was saying, Nano, you know. He said, you need about $5,000 to be... He says, you can't even do 5,000? The Nano in China. He said...
No, you can't.
To meet Chinese standards, you're talking at least $5,000.
Really?
That's what a lot of people don't know. A lot of the standards are starting to harmonize. Mm-hmm. The Brazilians finally figured out that they can't compete on the export market unless they legislate airbags into their cars. Oh my gosh, what brain trust finally figured that out? Of course, because they didn't have an airbag manufacturer down in Brazil to get the cost out of the component. They had to import all this stuff from Europe. Well, it made no sense. So they finally said, maybe we should put airbags in our cars. And now finally, they're at a platform where maybe they can compete on the open market by exporting some of their vehicles. But everybody, the Chinese, the Brazilians, they're all quickly harmonizing their standards because they essentially have to.
How? cheap can you do a car for this market? And I don't mean, you know, everyone goes for five-star rating, this and that. You only have to meet one star. That's the law. So I'm saying, if you say, I don't care what my safety rating is, as long as I meet the letter of the law. I don't care what my CO2 output is, as long as I meet emissions. How cheap a car could
you do? I'll bet you if you got some decent volume, maybe over 50,000 units a year at least, to get some of the cost out of the distribution and the parts network, I bet you anywhere around $6,000 or $7,000.
Wow. I thought you were going to say like 9 or 10.
No, no. I bet you probably could do a car in the 6 or 7 range.
Built where?
Vehicle. No, no. Vehicle like, or you can build them in India, possibly build them in Thailand. But, you know, a lot of people think China and Russia, but China actually is getting to be more of a higher cost market.
So what are the labor rates there now?
In China? Per hour? Well, it's definitely in, you know, it's well below $2 or $3 an hour in some cases. But logistics is very expensive in China. Getting stuff to the port, getting everything moved around, that's half the battle there.
More productivity at the plants, too, right?
Yeah, this is another misnomer, is that as you start to build more global platforms, you can only build them in one way. Like, for instance, you build an Epsilon, you build it in Trollhättan, you build it in Kansas City, and you build it in Korea. The process is all the same. You put the seats in at the same place, the glass in at the same place.
Build sequence.
So, I mean, there's a little bit more labor depending on the plant, but for the most part, they can't really differ that much in terms of how they build the vehicle because the quality will differ too much. And so I think that as the world keeps moving along, global platforms are going to start to continue to level the field a little bit. So,
see, the rumors are heating up about the C7 Corvette.
What are you hearing?
Well, Ed Welburn confirmed it's got a split window. Inadvertently. But take a good look at the Stingray concept in Transformers 2. That's not the car, but there are very definitely hints of what the C7 looks like in that car.
No kidding.
Yeah, and another signal is that wasn't a running car to GM engineering's usual concept standards. Now it is. So that's heating up.
I remember going through the border at Windsor, and about five cars in front of us was a 63 split window. And my sons had never seen one in the flesh. And I said, kids, you don't see this car on the road too often. Take a look at that. And, oh, my God, that's beautiful. And we went through, and the customs guard, even before he said what nationality, he said, do you see that split window? He goes, I'm still dreaming about it.
They're coming out. When's C7 coming out?
12.
Well, I expect that car to blow us away. Because, you know, we've all been talking about naming off all these great GM products. And
oh, there's a lot riding on
this.
We've
talked to GM Design, Ed in particular, about the interior of the Corvette when we were at Dream Cruise. And I didn't realize it was a split window that's coming, too.
What would be the big win here or sort of surprise new product or something that GM could do that could really kind of change the discussion about the company? I mean, is it the Cadillac Converge? Is it getting the Corvette C7 out a hell of a lot earlier than people expect?
You know, to me, I always thought if they could come with a mainstream hit of some kind, as an enthusiast, yeah, I like all this stuff. I like the CTS-V and I like the Corvette. But if a domestic manufacturer came up with a mainstream car hit that was an instant cult car for any number of reasons, looks, value, overall performance, just everything, just an irresistible thing. Like, we may never see that again like we saw with the Mustang.
Right.
But remember those huge sales numbers,
yeah,
the Mustang.
400,000 plus.
We'll never see that again in this kind of market. No. But a cult success would be, what, 200,000?
Mm.
You know,
Do it with that.
We need a mainstream.
Oh, here's the split window concept you're talking about.
Yeah, that's the Stingray concept.
Wow.
When you see that thing in the flesh, I mean, people have seen it on the screen. When you see that thing in,
really cool.
Oh yeah, when you see that thing in the flesh, it is absolutely stunning.
Actually could really say that. I mean, that's such a stunning design.
That just continues.
Cool?
Yeah, no, that's nice proportions
there.
Oh
gosh.
But what they need to do is the next Impala has got to be the 55 Chevy.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean retro at all.
No.
I'm just saying that level of a success.
The concept, yes, of the 55, which was great design, great performance, great value.
Right.
Those three things.
Right.
And an American manufacturer needs to deliver that.
And, you know, think about it. You know, you were talking about the Malibu earlier. Last I looked, Impala's outselling the Malibu, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that should tell you something, that they've got a sales problem, not a product problem.
You know, I that Malibu car is old. That platform is ancient. The design looks really
dated. No, you mean Impala.
I'm sorry, yeah, Impala.
Right.
That's
God,
the car.
Look at that car. Oh, my God.
The Impala is the car that they need to redesign fast and do it.
They are bringing another Impala, but off of Global Epsilon. It would be off the same platform as LaCrosse.
And I know, but and it's going to be bigger than
It'll be a Malibu. Bit bigger. Oh, yeah, it'll be bigger than Malibu. It'll be LaCrosse size, a little bit bigger than LaCrosse.
But it needs to be something it's got to be a breakthrough product. Well, if it is, it could do a hell of a lot for the company because they do great volume on that.
This is the other problem, though. You know, I can remember back in, 83 when Chrysler brought out the minivan. And it took somebody 10 years to finally figure out how to make a minivan Ford. And they didn't really do that good of a job at it, but they got pretty close. 10 years. Well, there's no 10-year head start anymore. You're lucky if you got a year and a half, maybe 2 years these days. So if you got a hit, you got to keep following that sucker up.
Right.
There's none of this old where he's going to ride the wave on this thing for a while. There's no riding waves anymore. You got to keep following it up on a regular basis. That's the other problem, too.
But isn't that Impala? The new Impala, like 2012 or 13 or something like that?
It's late 11, early 12 kind of idea. Yeah, it's still a ways off.
That's something they should move up because it could be a high-volume hit for them. I mean, I think a lot of the volume on it right now that's so good is Fleet, right? Isn't that the Fleet?
Fleet, yeah, they're doing a pretty good job on Fleet. You drove, I'm finally going to get to drive it tomorrow. I can't believe it's taking me forever, but the new Taurus.
Yeah.
I'm finally going to get to drive it tomorrow, but I know you've driven it.
Real good driving car. Yeah. Real good driving car.
The design
car.
On that is growing on me.
Fantastic road car.
Yeah. I'm not sold on the exterior styling. I love the interior instrument panel. I'm blown away by that. I love the high level of the center console and the like. But to me, are you getting an EcoBoost one, do you know?
I think we're getting an EcoBoost when I'm away in China. But
well, that is a sweet combination.
Yeah, but the design, I know what you're saying, Jen. The design, they almost like sort of gave up on it about 75% of the way.
Yeah, there's certain things that just don't work for me.
They could have reached a little more with that car.
Mm-hmm. But
it feels like a damn S-Class when you're driving it. It is like it's so solid.
It's quiet. You can actually have a conversation in that car, from what I understand. Whereas there's a lot of cars these days that are still pretty noisy. You can't, you're not yelling at people, but in that car, you can actually have a conversation.
Well, and this sort of brings us full circle. The reason that car works so well, especially with the EcoBoost, again, is the software controlling everything. And Ford just said they got, 150 different, or no, they've applied for 150 different patents. And everybody went, to your point, Peter, wait a minute, direct injection has been around and turbocharging.
It's a combination.
And they said what we're really patenting is how the software integrates it all.
And their future EcoBoost engines, the small four cylinders are the
1.6.
ones that are really going to blow everybody away.
Right.
Yep. That's where the rubber's going to meet the road.
Yeah, that is going to be a spectacular package.
Because I think we all know some of the larger V6s could always get a little bit better fuel economy. But
yeah. Well, Michael, great having you here, man. This was good. This was really good. Good conversation. A lot of good information here.